Hi, welcome back to the Incidental Economist Podcast. Today's date is September 30th, 2011. I'm Aaron Carroll.
And I'm Austin Fracht.
And today we'd like to spend some time talking about how research actually gets done and funded. There's a lot of misinformation out there in the way that a lot of actual research gets done, especially at the sort of academic or university or public level, and a lot of misunderstandings about how a lot of this gets funded. I mean, I can speak for myself. The vast majority of my time is actually spent doing publicly funded research. I have a fair amount of funding from the NIH or from AHRQ, which is another sort of public research house, sort of not exactly the NIH, but sort of like the NIH, and then some funding from foundational level as well. I can't speak for you, Austin. Is it similar?
No. I just, the money just rolls in. I don't know where it comes from. I sit in my ivory tower and I spin my theories, and then I put on the blog, and I know they're right. So I don't need to do any research.
I
like you, have to. I have to fight every day for every dime of funding. I probably spend a quarter of my year, maybe a third, depending on the year, of actually either thinking about or actively writing proposals, or I actually participate in scoring proposals, and we can talk about that process, and I think you have as well. And there's a lot of time spent in convincing others that you're worthy of the funding. And then subsequent to that, a lot of time and effort spent convincing others that the work you've done and written up in form of a paper is worthy of publication. So by the time you go from conception of an idea to a published paper, a lot of people have scrutinized it, and you've accommodated a lot of critiques and changed your methods accordingly. And I think going through that process, because I'm sure many people who haven't not familiar with it or haven't thought about it may think, as I was facetiously saying, we just kind of sit around and the funding comes in through, you know, tuition from students or what have you, and we like make stuff up, but no, it's nothing of the sort.
Yeah, and this is one of those where it's so big, I'm trying to even think of the best place to start, but I guess it's worth just describing.
We can go end to end. I mean, we could start with, you know,
the
conception of an idea, getting funding, the scoring of projects, revision, you know, so on. So we could
even before then, I was just going to say, I mean, the first thing to know is just there, just even from the NIH, many, many, many different kinds of grants. Most sort of faculty that we see at our level, when they start out, we encourage them, the first thing to do is to go after what we call a career development award, or otherwise known as a K award. And these are grants
K
that
for
last
career.
Actually, maybe it is, but I don't know. It lasts for like these grants last for like 3 to 5 years, and what's really amazing about them is that they usually will pay for 75% of your salary up to a certain amount, which, from a funding standpoint, is nearly unheard of for the rest of your career.
Yeah.
The fact that you can get one grant and then sort of be mostly done, because again, in my world, and again, it may be different in yours, usually people want to do some clinical work, be it 20% time or something like that, and maybe a little bit extra, like spend one day a week in clinic or the hospital. I do actually less than that. If you read the blog, you know, clinical medicine and I just don't mix so much anymore. But
me neither.
So that means you have to fund, but yeah, exactly. You have to fund like 75, 85, or for me, like 95% of your salary, which means getting one grant that pays 75% of your time is phenomenal. That rarely happens after the K award.
Yeah, usually a grant will fund, well, it varies a lot, but roughly speaking, a good grant will fund for us, you know, maybe 30% of our time.
That's
so you got to do, you know, working on 3 or 4 things at the same time.
And that it's about the same, I think, for me. You know, a big so after the K, then usually after the other kind of award that most of us go after is what's called an R award, which is usually some sort of investigator-initiated primary research project. And they can range from very small projects in the level of an R03, which may be like $100,000 spread over 2 years, you know, all the way up to, say, an R01, which can be on the order of, you know, $1 to $2 million spread over anywhere from 3 to 5 years. But getting one of these is incredibly difficult. I think we ought to talk about that and then actually about how the budgeting works. So if you want to run us through how it goes from conception on forward?
Well, I'll tell you, I only know I know a little bit about the NIH, but mostly I know about it through the VA. I have an appointment at the VA, Department of Veterans Affairs, and I'm a principal investigator. I do research in the VA, and that because I'm a VA employee, I have access to the VA research funding. The VA has its own stream of research funding, and the VA model for deciding which proposals to fund is it's modeled on the NIH model. So the way it works is it's investigator initiated, and what that means is investigators out in the field like me, like Aaron, we come up with the idea and we write a proposal which has to be structured as dictated by the, you know, it's got a certain format, and it all goes through an online process that checks the margins and the font size, and you wouldn't believe how many details there are, how many hurdles you have to go through, and there's a mountain of paperwork and so forth. So you do all that, but the fundamental nuts and bolts of it from a research standpoint is it's got your research protocol. It says what your hypotheses are, what your objectives are, what the relevant background is, what the significance is, what you're going to do analytically, where you're going to get the data, how you're going to protect, you know, human subjects and protect the data and all that kind of stuff, and that explains what you're going to do. So then goes into the pile, and there are panels for different subject areas that meet, say, I don't know, roughly 20 people in a room a few times a year, and they have a pile of these to go through and decide what are we going to fund. Actually, they don't decide what we're going to fund. They decide how we're going to score it. And usually there's several people who've been assigned to each proposal. So I've submitted a proposal. Of two or three people are going to read it. Well, many people may read it, but three people have to read it and score it and write up a written review. And then they go to this meeting where there's, you know, 15 or 20 of their peers, and they discuss it and they present it and they say, here's what I like, here's what I don't like, here's why I scored it the way I did. And it's like golf. You want to get a low score. Each point up in the score is like a demerit. And after this whole process is done and they've scored, you know, 100 or more proposals, then the funding agency will kind of rank order them in terms of score, draw a line. I'm cutting some corners here, but roughly we draw a line, yep, and say, well, we can afford to fund all these that are the lowest scoring ones, namely the best, and we can't fund the other ones. And then in the VA, you get two more swings at it. So you'll get, if you don't get funded, you'll get the review back, the written reviews. They'll say, well, you know, this is what was good, but you didn't think about this aspect, or, you know, did you consider using this other data or whatever? And then you can respond to that, not once, but twice more. I think NIH maybe just once more. I can't remember.
Yeah, I'll go. I'll do the NIH when you're done.
Yeah. And so you get, in the VA, you get three bites at the apple. And but I'll tell you, the funding line's pretty low. Maybe between 5 and 10% of projects get funded each round. Now, you have three tries, so if you're persistent and you're good at responding to comments, you know, you can get your hit rate up to, you know, I've done very well. There's one sort of it's now kind of a joke how many efforts we made at trying to get this thing funded, but there's one thing I never got funded after trying in so many ways, but mostly eventually we succeed.
Yeah, and the NIH is mostly similar. I'm you know, someday I'd be interested to really look at an application and see how much they differ. But to apply for a, they apply almost all the same way, but slightly different in scale and in way the application works. For instance, in RO3, I think that the, you know, now the page limit is probably 5 pages or something like that of actual text describing what you want to do. At the RO1 level, it's 12. It used to be almost twice that.
Oh, the VA still twice 25 that.
25 pages.
The VA still 25 pages.
Yeah, 25. And that was only for, but see, that was part of the, that was actually almost the, as close you get the fun part. Because by the time you were done collecting everybody's bio sketch and doing all the individual budgets and getting all the different facilities and describing all the places about the university and the context and getting together all the letters of support, you have to get massive letters of support, you know, from the top level down saying that everybody's going to participate and everyone's going to be give you what you need to get done. By the time you're done, these documents are used to, I used to have to do them in paper and send them up by FedEx. Mm-hmm. They were like hundreds of pages long.
Yeah. And you've spent 2/3 of your time just chasing around,
correct,
getting signatures and, you know, a lot of,
and I mean, to get these
groups.
Yeah, getting these things together is a full-time job.
Yes,
and and so the NIH usually runs on a 4-month cycle. So usually every October, every February, and every June is when you submit primary applications. When you're doing resubmissions, it's all shifted a month back. So it's every 4 months, but a month back. And These days at the NIH, you only get two bites at the apple. Mm-hmm. So when we send in an application, that right off the bat, they only even score half of them. So if your application is not in the top half, you just are told it's unscored. But you don't know if it was the 99th percentile or the 51st percentile. But either way, these days, with only two bites of the apple, it's almost impossible to go from the 51st percentile to a scorable number. So if you're unscored, it's over. And what's really hard and people don't get is, if I've spent months putting an application together and it's unscored, it's as if I didn't do anything those months. I mean, it's just wasted time. That is incredibly demoralizing. And again, half of all applications fall into that batch, and sometimes for reasons that are just ridiculous. You know, it is a little bit of a capricious process. There's still a lot of human error in there. And so that's hard to get over. But even if you're lucky and you make it into the top half, and you get a score, again, as Austin said, pay lines these days are so low because of the budget cuts that sometimes they're funding the top, you know, let's say 10%. We'll even be generous. 10% of grants. So unless yours is in the top 10%, you better hope that it's close so that you can do it on a resubmission. So again, you've spent months hoping that this might get scored. You're told it's in the 25th percentile, which is great. And then you're going to spend probably a month or two trying to get it buffed up and hope that the next time it's at the 9th percentile, hopefully that people will remember it and give it a good score. But it takes, you know, you submit that first grant, you start working on it, it takes 4 months to send it in. Then the NIH gets it. And then it takes about 6 months before it actually gets to the study section. Then they review it. Then you get a score. Then it's going to take another 2 months, say, until the council meets. So even in a perfect world, from when you start to work on the grant till you actually might get money.
I'm glad you mentioned that timing, because one thing we try to do in our work is make it policy relevant. Well, that means you have to anticipate what might be policy relevant a year ahead of time, which is extremely hard.
Yep. I'd actually say it's impossible. And that's kudos to you, because I've had almost no success in funding my policy related stuff, because that timeline often kills you. And it's like, the problem is too, is I remember I submitted a proposal. I wanted to do some survey work for the last presidential election. Well, I didn't get it, the grant, on the first try. And I realized, well, that was a year away. But when you don't get the perfect score, if you go back, resubmit, you're waiting another 9 months. And so at that point, I'm like, well, I just missed the election. And so you have to be perfect at the first swing. That's almost impossible these days. And so in a more realistic world, if you get it on the second bite, you're going to get funding maybe, you know, 1.5 to 2 years after you initially started to work on this. And that's, while that's going on, you have to keep yourself funded in all these other ways.
So what you have to do if you're going to do this professionally is you have a pipeline. You just, obviously you can't go without an income for 2 years. So you're just constantly feeding the pipeline and hoping that a certain percentage of them are funded, because otherwise you'll have a hole in your budget.
And that's why, I mean, yeah, with rare exception, I do not miss a funding cycle, which means that we're submitting something on the order of an R01 every 4 months, which means that we have to put together a multi-hundred page document grant every 4 months and submit it and hope it gets funded, knowing that most of them likely won't. And that's while we're actually conducting the research that we have gotten funded. And this is an enormous amount of sort of time and infrastructure, and it sometimes we give the illusion of making it look easy, but it takes a massive amount of time and effort and writing and keeping everything organized to keep everything constantly.
Well, I want to get to the paper publication part of it. Should we?
Oh yeah, well, I want to hit budget. One other thing, because I got to hit budget, because the biggest thing that I get all the time is, I remember I got my first big grant. Let's say it was $2 million. And I remember my father saying to me, like, oh, my God, that's fantastic. You know, how much are you going to pay yourself?
You're set for life, right? $2 million, you can retire.
$2 million. Like, I'm going to write. How much could this? Well, people, like, don't get, first of all, that when you get a large grant from the NIH and say, you know, you tell them it's going to cost $1 million, that then there's what's called indirects, where another $500,000 or so comes in, and that goes to the university, and that theoretically is supposed to pay the rent and the electricity,
space,
and, you know, the infrastructure and everything else that we might need that's not in the grant. But the rest of it, the $1 million and what we call direct costs, it's a line item budget. And so I have to say, I'm going to spend 25% of my time doing this. This is my salary. Therefore, 25% of my time equals X. And we're going to use a biostatistician, and that's going to take 30% of the biostatistician's time. And the biostatistician's salary is Y. And so that's how much this is going to cost. And we're going to need to recruit 300 patients, and it'll cost X amount per patient. And that, so everything is planned. It's not a, they don't send me a million.
It's also over a certain
check.
Number of years. So it's 25% of your time.
Correct.
For 2-3 years or whatever it is.
Right. And so you get, basically the biggest part of the budgets is people's salaries, because I, you know, it's a huge infrastructure. By the time you're done with research assistants and all the faculty who are working on it and staff and maybe a subcontract and biostatisticians and data managers, it's all of their salaries. That's the biggest part of the grant. No one just dumps $1 million in my lap and says, you know, figure it out. And so
it can be a little more to be a little more explicit about this, you know, a junior PI, a principal investigator on a research project, or a good biostatistician, and so forth. Just in round terms, let's just say a salary of $100,000, you know, on the order of that, is completely reasonable. On top of that, you have health insurance, right? So you got to jack that up by, you know.
Yep.
Another what's fringe? Well, health, not just health insurance, but also fringe in terms of retirement.
I can tell you, our benefit rate 30%. Is like 30%. So it's like if it was 100,000, it's another $30,000.
That's benefits. That's,
so I mean, yeah.
Yep. And then there's overhead. Too. So overhead, you can in many cases double it. So you're at 130. You're at 260. You're at $250,000 for if you were going to get one full time, the equivalent of one full time, you know, professional researcher is $250,000 a year.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, and so it just gets eaten up incredibly fast. And, you know, when people say, oh my God, they spent millions of dollars to investigate this, well, that's people's salaries over the course of a year and their benefits. It's not that they get a salary from the university and then when they get millions of dollars, all of a sudden they're just piling it into a pot. Every dollar of grant money that I get in has already been allocated for and going out, and the vast majority of it is for salary and benefits. That's how the university pays them. They don't pay them and then get the money.
Right.
So, That's why research costs so much.
So after you've convinced the panel to give you a good score and you get it funded, and in doing so you've already responded to critiques and refined your plan, now you get to implement it. So you do your work over some number of years and you try to publish. And now it's actually a little bit of a different game, but there's some similarities. You basically have to convince a couple of reviewers and an editor of some journal that you've done work worthy of publication. And that can take, in some cases, about the same time as getting a grant funded. Usually less, you know, in the economics world, where I often publish, it's not unusual from time of submission of a paper to seeing it in print to be, a year would be fast. Let's put it that way.
If it's accepted.
Yes. You submit it, and maybe it'll be rejected, just saying, you know, sorry, this just is not good enough, and it's not going to get there.
I just want that can take months, too.
I mean,
getting rejected
6 months,
is not an instantaneous thing.
You can wait 6 months for the no thank you. But you'll usually get reviewer comments, so then at least you have some feedback, and you can revise it. And if the feedback is mild enough, there's accept with major revision, so you have quite a bit of work to do, and there's accept with minor revision, you just have some tweaks to do. But again, you're convincing some people who are very serious in their critiques. They're not going to take them lightly. You have to get, you know, we're all opinionated, and you have to get through some very opinionated people who think you don't know what you're doing sometimes. And meanwhile, when you read their comments, their review comments, you think they didn't read the paper sometimes. And you still have to be nice. and it's really hard. By the time it's published, and this doesn't mean everything that gets published is a jewel. There's a lot of junk that gets published. But by the time it's published, a lot of people, intelligent people who work hard, have scrutinized what you plan to do and what you actually have done. And that's the value. You know, you don't get that in, as Aaron said, in a conference paper. You don't get that in a think tank white paper. You know, you don't get that on a blog, frankly. You know, our blog posts are not peer reviewed, but we're citing peer reviewed work. You know, so the peer review means it's undergone considerable scrutiny, and that also means that, you know, smart people have already suggested a million things. It's very likely that if you see a quote from a paper or an excerpt from a paper and you're thinking, oh, well, they probably didn't control for XYZ, or, you know, they didn't consider this or that, it's pretty likely they did.
Yeah, and, you know, and this is a continual frustration of mine in the comments, where I will put up a paper and somebody will actually just say, I bet they didn't do X and Y, it's crap. And just, go check. First of all, I can promise you that Austin and I do check. And I wouldn't put anything up that didn't control for the stuff that you would imagine. But, you know, go and look before you just assume, because, again, the vast majority of peer-reviewed research, they're doing that kind of rigor.
Yeah. But, you know, that doesn't mean it's correct. It's just, it's,
nope.
It's,
agreed.
I would say, most research that's published, you know, it passes the laugh test. If you want to poke holes in it, you have to do some serious work. And often you can poke holes in it because nothing's perfect, but it's very hard to just, you know, read the title and the abstract and say, well, this has got to be wrong because there's no way they didn't consider such and such. And,
right, and I think it's just because, I mean, they're going to take the basic steps. If they didn't, then the journal will get, you know, laughed out of publication. Right. And so there are often imperfections, but not nearly on the order of those that many commenters assume, of just, like, not controlling for socioeconomic status or gender or for race. I mean, those are just simple things, and it's the kind of thing too where it's like, you know, that we're looking for that. I don't just trust the peer review either. I go read the paper and make sure that they do that kind of rigor, or else I'm not going to put it on the blog. And not to get maudlin about it, you know, none of us are complaining. I love my job. Austin loves his job. I will complain about the process sometimes, but it is, I mean, I knew what I was getting into. I knew it would require this kind of, like, constant being in the rat race, and it is what it is. And it, you know, the good side is I get to do what I love, and it's a job and a career that I...
Well,
that
and the other thing is that this is taxpayer money, and it should be taken seriously.
Yeah.
It's a balance. You want to be careful with the money, and you want it to fund things of value, but you also want to be careful that you're not wasting researchers' time, because their time does cost a lot of money. So, you know, you want to balance it. You want to get good quality people doing good work, but you don't want them spending, you know, an exorbitant amount of time, you know, just filling out paperwork. And and some of that has to be done, but, you know, you want to keep a balance.
So, bottom line, if there are any funders listening, please fund us, because, you know, it just makes everything so much better. Anyway, thanks for listening. This is the Incidental Economist Podcast with Aaron Carroll and Austin Frack, and we'll see you next week.